Your trust's complaint office managed to arrange the meeting on the anniversary of the patient's death. Not your trust, Henry, said the chief executive. Our trust. The anniversary of a death is the worst possible date for such a meeting. Have you ever come across so-called anniversary reactions? Grieving relatives are particularly difficult to handle on these occasions. Well, yes, we did have one of those recently, didn't we? He said, turning to the director of surgery. Nor was there any meeting with me beforehand with your trust staff about the basis of the complaint, I added. Our trust, he corrected me again. But it's true that the procedure is that there should have been a meeting beforehand. Well, the procedure wasn't followed, but I'm sorry if I handled the meeting badly, I said. But you try sitting opposite the parents of a patient who has died and who are convinced you killed their child. It's even more difficult when the accusation is absurd, even though I did get the diagnosis wrong, and he was subjected to an unnecessary operation. The chief executive was silent. I couldn't do your job, he said at last. Well, I couldn't do yours, I replied, filled with sudden gratitude for his understanding. I thought of all the government targets, self-serving politicians, tabloid headlines, scandals, deadlines, civil servants, clinical cock-ups, financial crises, patient pressure groups, trades unions, litigation, complaints, and self-important doctors with which an NHS chief executive must deal. The average time for which they serve, not surprisingly, is only 4 years. We looked at each other for a few moments. But your communications office is crap, I said. All I'm asking is that you use your undoubted abilities for our trust, he said. We want you to follow established procedures, the director of surgical services added, feeling obliged to contribute to the meeting. After the meeting, I made my way back out of the labyrinth and returned to my office. Later that day, I emailed the communications department my suggestions for a better poster. We need your help, it began, but I never received a reply. The chief executive left the trust a few weeks later. He had been redirected to another trust with financial difficulties, where no doubt he was to wield the axe again on behalf of the government and the civil servants in the Treasury and Department of Health. He had lasted 2 years. I heard a rumour a few months later that he was on sick leave from his new trust because of stress, and slightly to my surprise, I felt sorry for him. Chapter 14. Neurotmesis. Noun. The complete severance of a peripheral nerve. Complete recovery of function is impossible. On the first day of June, the weather suddenly hot and humid, I cycled to work for the morning meeting. Before setting off, I had gone into my small back garden to inspect my 3 beehives. The bees were already hard at work, shooting up into the air, probably heading for the flowering lime trees that grow along one side of the local park. As I pedalled to work, I thought happily of the honey I would be harvesting later in the summer. I arrived a few minutes late. One of the senior house officers was presenting the cases. The first case, she said, is a 62-year-old man who works at one of the local hospitals as a security man. He lives on his own and has no next of kin. He was found confused at home. His colleagues had gone round to look for him because he hadn't turned up for work. There were many bruises on his right side, and his colleagues said that he had had increasing difficulties with talking over the previous 3 weeks. "Did you see him when he was admitted?" I asked her. Knowing that the house officers presenting the cases at the morning meeting will rarely have seen the patients they present because of their short working shifts. "Well, actually, I did," she said. "He was dysphagic and had a slight weakness on the right side." "So what's the diagnosis going to be?" I asked. It's a short history of a progressive neurological deficit. It involves speech, she replied. The bruises on the right side of his body suggests he's falling to the right, so he's probably got a progressive problem on the left side of his brain, probably in the frontal lobe. Yes, very good. What sort of problem? Maybe a GBM or maybe a subdural? Quite right. Let's have a look at the scan. As she worked at the computer keyboard, the slices of the poor man's brain scan slowly appeared. It showed what was obviously a malignant tumour in the left cerebral hemisphere. Looks like a GBM, somebody said. There were two medical students that morning in the audience. The SHO turned to them, probably enjoying the fact that there was somebody even lower in the strict medical hierarchy than herself. A GBM, she said in a knowledgeable tone of voice, is a glioblastoma multiforme, a very malignant primary brain tumour. These are fatal tumours, I added for the benefit of the students. A man his age with a tumour like this has only a few months, maybe only weeks to live. If he's treated, which means partial surgical removal and then radiotherapy and chemotherapy afterwards, he'll only live a few months longer at best, and he probably won't regain his speech anyway. Well, James, I said, turning to one of the registrars, the SHO has been spot on with the diagnosis. What is the management of this case, and what are the really important points here? He's got a malignant tumour we can't cure, James replied. He's disabled despite steroids. All we can do is a simple biopsy and refer him for radiotherapy. Yes, but what's really important about the history? James hesitated, but before he could reply, I said that what was important was that he had no next of kin. He'd never get home. He'd never be able to look after himself. He had only a few months of life left, whatever we did. And since he had no family, he was likely to spend what little time he had left miserably on a geriatric ward somewhere. But I told James he was probably right. It would be easier to get him back to his local hospital if we established the diagnosis formally. So I said that we had better get a biopsy and bounce him off to the oncologists. We could only hope that they'd be sensible and not prolong his suffering by treating him. The fact of the matter was that we already knew the diagnosis from the scan, and any operation would be something of a charade. I pulled out a USB stick from my pocket and walked up to the computer at the front of the viewing room. "I'll show you all some amazing brain scans from my last trip to Ukraine," I said, but I was interrupted by one of my junior colleagues. "Excuse me," he said, "but the manager responsible for the junior doctor's working hours has very kindly agreed to come and talk to us about the new rota for the registrars, and she can't stay beyond 9 o'clock, since she has another meeting to go to afterwards. She'll be here in a minute." I was annoyed that I was not going to be able to show some enormous Ukrainian brain tumours, but clearly I had no choice in the matter. The manager was late. So while we waited for her to arrive, I walked round to the operating theatres to see the only patient for the day's operating. He was waiting in the anaesthetic room, lying on a trolley, a young man with severe sciatica from a simple disc prolapse. I had seen him 6 months earlier. He was a computer programmer, but also a competitive mountain biker, and had been training for some kind of national championship when he developed excruciating sciatic pain down his left leg. An MRI scan had shown the cause to be a slipped disc, a herniated intervertebral disc causing S1 nerve root compression, in medical terms. His disc prolapse had prevented him from training, and he had had to drop out of the mountain biking championships to his bitter disappointment. He had been very frightened by the prospect of surgery and decided to see if he would get better on his own, which, I had told him, often happened if one waited long enough. This had not happened, however, and he had now reluctantly decided to undergo surgery. "Good morning," I said, my voice full of surgical reassurance. genuine reassurance since the planned operation was a simple one. Most patients